could have made you stand the rest of the time. You guys ever been to a wedding and that happens? You just stand there and stand there. The minister's supposed to tell you 15 minutes ago to sit down. Been there, done that. Charlie Kirk's memorial service is scheduled today in Arizona. And I had a rare visitor come see me on Friday. I don't know if you guys remember Jim Lehman, but he came to see me on Friday. And he wasn't too proud to ride the chairlift, so I sent him downstairs on the chairlift, and we had a two-hour conversation. And during this conversation, we both agreed that before September 10th, we didn't know very much about Charlie Kirk at all, because we're just a little too old to be his target audience. He's mainly targeted at the college age. We knew he was married and had kids. We knew he was young. We knew he was a strong Christian. We also knew he was controversial. And that was about it. Today, I know a lot more. And one of the things that I know now is Charlie prayed this prayer every morning. Lord, how do you want me to serve you today? In an effort to find out the truth about him, I watched more podcasts about Charlie than I should have. I read more articles than I should have. Some of the things I read and heard were like this: if your pastor doesn't talk about Charlie Kirk, you should leave your church. Then I heard the opposite: if my pastor talks about Charlie Kirk, I am leaving my church. You can imagine my dilemma. I am deeply grieved by how polarized our country has become. Polarized is a great word for where we are today. It means something that is divided into two completely opposing groups or factions, often in a way that creates a lack of a middle ground. Where we are today is, if you disagree with my opinions, you're not worthy to live. There is no middle ground. Isaiah 1:18 tells us, "Come now, let us reason together." The goal of reasoning together is not to win the argument, but to win the person, and in our case, to win them to Christ. We can't reason together today because, for the most part, we are only willing to listen to our preferred news media source and never to each other. By now, you all know what I think of the media. It's full of lying liars who lie, and you absolutely have to fact-check everything they say. If they say basketballs bounce up and down, you better Google it. The media has been reporting that Charlie Kirk was a Nazi, a racist, he hated gays and transgenders. And I thought, those sound like really weird attitudes for serious Christians to maintain. So I read a really long article by a black man who had watched 50 hours of Charlie Kirk's videos, and he said he couldn't find one racist thing. And the one thing that I found was he told a black mother that her child was a gift from God. And then I found this.
I just want to say I'm a transgender male. What age should kids be able to get things like hormone therapy? Because I don't know what's true, what's not.
Tell me, are you comfortable telling me your story?
I've known that since like third grade, and I'm currently 19, almost 20. I've known basically since then. I didn't start going by like a different name until seventh and eighth grade. I just don't know, like, with the whole medical stuff, like what's true, what's not, what's helpful, because I've heard so many different opinions.
First of all, thank you so much for that.
Yeah, of course.
So I'm going to have an opinion that very few people will ever tell you, which is I want you to be very cautious putting drugs into your system in the pursuit of changing your body.
Mm-hmm.
I instead encourage you to work on what's going on in your brain first. I think what you need first and foremost is just a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Just someone that is going to listen to what you've gone through, listen to what else is going on. My prayer for you, this, and again, very few people will say this, I actually want to see you be comfortable in how you were born.
Yeah.
I know that you might not feel that way, but I think that is something that you can achieve. I think that with the right team and the right people, you don't have to wage war on your body. You can learn to love your body.
Sounds reasonable to me. Well, Jim and I have been sick over what has happened to Charlie. We were sick over the idea that his wife will now have to carry on without him. We are sick that his little children will not remember him. We are also sickened by the public's reaction to his assassination. There are two extremes. One is to deify him, which I do not believe Charlie would have wanted. And the other extreme is to dance on his grave. The hatred between sides is palpable. Everyone is blaming this side or that side. I think we've got to put our fingers back in their holsters. I think it's having a horrible impact on young adults. Is a world filled with hate, division, and blame what we want to leave for our children and grandchildren? I'm not sure we've even thought about the terrible example that we are setting for them. I think the example we've already set has caused a lot of this. It doesn't seem to matter, though, as long as we don't have to pay for it. There once was a king named Hezekiah whose only concern was that he didn't have to pay for his sins and mistakes. He said, "Let the kids take care of it. Let them suffer for it." In the course of Hezekiah's reign, he becomes seriously ill, and so the prophet Isaiah goes on a hospital visit. Now, Isaiah has terrible bedside manners. Isaiah tells Hezekiah flat out, "You're going to die, Jack." And Hezekiah is terrified at the thought. So his only recourse at this point is to pray. And God, in turn, grants him 15 more years to live. If we knew Hezekiah today, we would respect him. Yet, like so many of his colleagues, he starts out with a bang and ends with a thud. It reminds me of watching gymnastics during the Olympics. It's a real nail biter, isn't it? No matter how great they start off, you know the landing is coming. Gymnast Paul Hamm never missed a landing, never, until the 2004 Summer Olympics in Athens. Hamm goofed up his landing so badly in the vault event that he nearly knocked over the judges. Up until then, he had been picture perfect, but he goofed up the landing. Unfortunately, it is what people do at the end is what everybody remembers. What Hezekiah does is goof up the landing. It is what we remember about him. God will judge his nation, but Hezekiah isn't going to live to see it. His descendants will face the business end of God's judgment, and Hezekiah does not seem to care. We read a bit of his story in Isaiah 39, 1 through 8. Soon after this, Merodach-Baladan, son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent Hezekiah his best wishes and a gift. He had heard that Hezekiah had been very sick and that he had recovered. Hezekiah was delighted with the Babylonian envoys and showed them everything in his treasure houses, silver, the gold, the spices, the aromatic oils. He took them to see his armory and showed them everything in his royal treasuries. There was nothing in his palace or kingdom that Hezekiah did not show them. Then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and asked him, "What did these men want? Where were they from?" Hezekiah replied, "They came from the distant land of Babylon." "What did they see in your palace?" asked Isaiah. "They saw everything," Hezekiah replied. "I showed them everything I own, all my royal treasuries." Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Listen to this message from the Lord of Heaven's armies. The time is coming when everything in your palace, all the treasures stored up by your ancestors until now, will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. Some of your very own sons will be taken away into exile. They will become eunuchs who will serve in the palace of Babylon's king." Then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, "This message you have given to me from the Lord is good." For the king was thinking, "At least there will be peace and security during my lifetime." Hezekiah has been so sick that he nearly dies, and the king of Babylon sends flowers and a card. "Dear Hezekiah, get well soon." On its face, it looks so nice. He's respecting a fellow royal. However, this gesture has a hidden agenda. The Babylonian king wants Hezekiah to form a coalition with him against Assyria. Hezekiah is already feeling threatened by the Assyrians, and this makes him persuadable. Hezekiah has no business buddying up with the king of Babylon because he was a pagan. The king of Babylon would have viewed himself as a freedom fighter, but in today's world, he would have been seen as a terrorist. Hezekiah has already been worried about Assyria, so the Babylonians had him at hello. This special attention makes him feel like one of the boys, and he gladly welcomes the Babylonian envoy. Wanting to impress the guys, he shows them his vast wealth. He has supplies of food, he has military armaments, gold, silver, livestock, spices, you name it, he's got it. The visitors are very impressed and they're taking notes. The Babylonians weren't there for tea and crumpets. They are there to scope out the place. While Hezekiah does not seem to know they are frenemies, the Babylonians certainly do know it. Hezekiah is a king from a lowly nation which has very little power, and Babylon is an up-and-coming superpower. To gain more prominence in the Babylonians' eyes, he will now do whatever he can to impress them, and he shows them everything they have. The text says there was nothing that Hezekiah did not show them. Showing these guys all his stuff is about the same thing as a banker showing a robber where all the money is. And then he shows them where the drawer is that has the key and the combination in it. And then he tells them what time would be the best time for him to come rob the place. Isaiah catches wind of this and goes to interrogate Hezekiah. What did these men say? Where did they come from? And what did they want? Isaiah probably knows the answers to all these questions because he's a prophet and prophets know stuff. It's very likely that these questions were crafted to give Hezekiah the opportunity to answer honestly, which he did, and to see the error of his ways, which he did not. Isaiah details what will happen because Hezekiah has shown all of the national goods to the Babylonians. All the stuff Hezekiah has just shown will be taken off by the Babylonians. They know right where it is, and they know just how to get it. Not only that, but the Babylonians will cart off Hezekiah's sons and grandsons and castrate them. This is no small thing in a nation. A king's son are his true riches. And how does Hezekiah respond? Well, let's do a multiple choice. A, I goofed up, may God have mercy on me. B, I'll do anything God wants me to do to make this right. Or C, whew, I dodged that bullet. Yep, it's C. Hezekiah should be distraught over the punishment that will come upon his country and his descendants, but he's not. He casually accepts God's verdict because he realizes by the time all this bad stuff happens, he'll be dead and gone. He is relieved to have dodged the bullet. What happens to Judah after he's gone is his fault. He is so squishy-faced that he refuses to see it as his own actions that has brought the doom upon generations to come. The attitude of not caring what happens in the years to come because you don't have to suffer is called the Hezekiah syndrome. Better you than me. As long as I don't have to suffer, why does it matter what I do or don't do? As long as it doesn't affect me, why should I care what others have to live through? Perhaps Hezekiah couldn't have done anything to avert the coming disaster, but the text tells us he does not even try. We don't even see him praying. This is odd behavior for a man who has previously experienced a miracle from the hand of God because he prayed. When his own life is in danger, he prays to God for deliverance. But when it comes to a serious problem facing people that are probably not even born yet, he can't be bothered. His sons, his grandsons, seem to bear no consequence in his mind. I don't know about you, but I care about my grandchildren, even those, Lord willing, who are yet to be born. There was a hog rooting around a tree looking for acorns. A bird in the tree warned him, "Hey, if you keep doing that, you're going to expose the roots, and that tree is eventually going to die, and your children will have nothing to eat, and they will starve." The hog didn't even look up but said, "Who cares as long as I have food while I'm alive?" The hog didn't give a hoot about the other hogs needing acorns in the coming years. He only cared about what he wanted. As long as he had a full belly, there is no need to care about the next generation. Though the next generation will perish, Hezekiah says, "No sweat, it doesn't affect me." Part of being a godly person is focusing on what happens after we're gone. Is what I am doing or saying today going to negatively affect those who come behind me? Do I live my life in such a way that does not take into consideration how it might change or damage someone else? A Greek proverb says, a society grows great when old men plant trees whose shade they know they'll never sit in. As God's people, we must leave blessings, not curses, behind for those who follow us. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, the ultimate test of a moral society is the kind of world it leaves to its children. What kind of world are we leaving to our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren? It is our sacred responsibility to the next generation to leave them a morally better world, a spiritually secure world, a world in which Satan has been rebuffed. Are we doing that? I worry that we are not. It is sheer ignorance to think that we can openly reject biblical values like we are currently doing without negatively affecting the next generations. It's not easy to speak out against the issues that harm our children and our grandchildren. We don't do it for the most part because it doesn't directly affect us. For most of us, more than half of our lives are over. We've almost made it out in one piece. Most of us had decent public educations. Most of us did not go to bed hungry or cold. Most of us do not face the level of crime that kids do today. Most of us will not face the grim repercussions of America's debt. If we don't get our nation's debt under control, our children and grandchildren will be left holding the bag. Recent calculations say if we had to write the check right now, it would cost over $500,000 per person. You guys got that? I don't have it. We can't write that check. By the time this bill falls on the kids, it will be lights out. But the adults just keep spending. When we let our own personal comfort be our guiding light, we are doing the same thing Hezekiah did. As long as I don't have to suffer, as long as I don't have to pay for it, as long as I get mine. It's the Hezekiah syndrome in our time. The Hezekiah syndrome is alive and well today. Many of us do pine for the way things were, and I wish we could go back too, but I'm sorry, those days are gone. We have to accept and see the way things are for real today, especially for our young people, and things are hard for them. I believe with all my heart that things are infinitely harder for kids than they were for me when I was a kid. Even my kids who are in their 30s, I think today's kids have it harder than they did. Like Hezekiah, even the best of us can become short-sighted and mortgage the future at the expense of the present. Though the next generation would die, Hezekiah said, well, at least I'll be okay. The older generation of God must reject this line of thinking. If we focus on Christ and not ourselves, it is possible to reach that generation, that lost generation. Very few of them even come to church anymore. A lot of them are atheists. If we have a servant heart, we can capture the hearts of today's generation. They are skeptical and cynical, partly because they know they've been lied to and they're starting to figure it out. They've seen how the older generation acts and speaks, and they see that it's not loving. And yet that generation will say, well, I'm a Christian. But then the next thing that happens is something terrible comes out of their face. We can turn this around if we choose to live like Jesus did. I've been trying to pray Charlie's prayer every day. Lord, how can I serve you today? And I admit, I don't know that I really want to pray that prayer, because what if God asks me to do something that I don't want to do that day? It's quite possible. But yet I'm going to do it, even though I don't necessarily want to, because I'm afraid of the answer. But I believe when we are willing to pray that prayer, how do you want me to serve you today, Lord? And prayers like it, we can learn how to serve a younger generation and reach them for Jesus Christ.